history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this beautiful country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are those seemingly ordinary Americans who really have done extraordinary things for our country. And there are also those who will never ever take their freedom for granted because they know what it's like to live without it. That's going to be our focus today as we once again seek to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we will never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And of course, along that journey, we end up learning so much. We're educated, we're entertained. So often we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If you're a regular listener to this show, there's no doubt that dates like December 7th, June 6th, May 8th, August 14th, those all hold significance for you. But there's another very important observance every year whose date changes just a little bit because it's always the third Friday in September. In the case of this year, that's September 15th. It's National POW/MIA Recognition Day. And all across our great nation this weekend, people are gathering to honor those who have endured the hardships of being a prisoner of war, and also to remember those who remain missing in action. In preparing for this program, I took a little inventory, and of the nearly 500 episodes of Hometown Heroes that are archived for you online, I counted 44 ex-prisoners of war interviewed in 14 different states. They represent the majority of states in our union if you go back to where they grew up. And I've been privileged to encounter quite a few more ex-POWs who have never shared their stories here. I'm continually amazed by their perspective, taking nothing for granted and persevering through everything that comes their way, even today. During World War II, more than 130,000 Americans were captured by enemy forces. That's less than 1% of the more than 16 million American men and women in uniform. But POW/MIA Recognition Day is also to remember the more than 82,000 Americans who remain missing in action. That includes 73,000 from World War II alone, and over 40,000 of them presumed lost at sea, a number that includes nearly 900 aboard the recently discovered cruiser USS Indianapolis. This day of remembrance exists to say to all of them, you are not forgotten. And wherever you're listening today, there are events in your area this weekend to honor POWs past and present, as well as those who are still missing. I hope you have a chance to go, because I know it'll leave an impression on you. And if you don't make it this weekend, I do know of at least one happening next weekend, because I'll be speaking at it in Bakersfield, California. I'll give you the details a little later, and I do have the info at hometownheroesradio.com, but two of the ex-prisoners of war who plan to be there are a combined 200 years old. Think about that. One is 98, the other 102. They've both shared their stories here on Hometown Heroes, and you're going to hear some excerpts from their stories in a bit. We'll hear from three different ex-POWs today, and one thing they all had in common, all three of them were married before they headed overseas. Just imagine what their wives and other family members went through as they learned they were missing, then captured, and wondered if they'd ever get to see him again. We're going to begin with Ray Maloney, originally from New York City. In November of 1944, just a week shy of his 22nd birthday, he would be shot down in the P-47 Thunderbolt he was piloting for the 86th Fighter Bomber Group in Italy.
The P-47 was so big and heavy that when you put that nose down and dive, it winds up like, you know, there's nothing could stay with it. And the word was always, if you get a 109 on your tail, head for the deck, because he's not going to be able to stay with you, you know. Mm-hmm. It winds up 400, 500, 600 miles an hour. And during the war, there were a number of occasions where fellows actually entered transonic. They almost went supersonic.
Yeah.
Paint would peel off the wings and things like this, you know, with a jug. And so being hit in a dive was really not a big worry, but it was when you were attacking people that could shoot back at you that, you know. And a lot of times there would be banks of, in fact, when I was shot down, it was a classic. It was a car with four banks of 20 millimeters, and each gun has four barrels. So you have 16 20 millimeters firing at you. And so long as you're, you know, going by, they have to lead you so much that rarely can they get you. But as soon as you turn around and start committing, you know, now you become a stable target. You're coming right at them. You know? And you can see these baseballs coming at you, you know, as you go down. But
you mean you had your eyes open?
yeah, you better. Because there's other guys doing it too, you know. You know, we don't want to collide with each other.
So you're in a dive, and this anti-aircraft artillery is coming up at you. And where did it hit your plane?
I don't know. It was in the fuel system somewhere because I felt the bang, you know. And it took a few seconds as I peeled off and I saw some more of the baseballs, you know, coming back at you. Within a few seconds, I noticed my fuel pressure started to fluctuate. And then finally it started to zero, and I panicked. I didn't. And the P-47 has, for starting your engine, there's a little primer. Mm-hmm. You turn it into a little primer right on the instrument panel. And so the only thing I could think of, I uncorked it and started turning it, and I could bring the fuel pressure up, I could, you know, a little bit, so it kept the engine running while I primed, and I peeled off this thing and started making a turn south. And I told him, I said, I'm hit. And my wingman stayed with me, and I thought, well, maybe, and I got it up to, I think, about 7 or 8,000 feet, still pumping like mail at this thing.
Was your arm getting tired of pumping that little
prime? Yeah, I was frightened to death, you know. And my wingman said, you're smoking, it looks like you're on fire. He couldn't see fire, but he could see smoke coming out of me. So I said, yeah, I think I am on fire, because it seemed to be getting warm in the cockpit. But I started to head south, and you got to cross the Apennine Mountains in Italy. I can't remember what the altitudes were. Probably maybe 8,000 on down, you know.
Sure.
And again, without power, the P-47 is so heavy, it's only going one way when you don't have power, and that's down. And so I couldn't hold altitude. I kept falling down. And finally, I got to a point where I had a kind of a hill, a mountain in front of me, and I knew I couldn't clear that, so I turned this way and headed down, and now I'm down in a valley. And it's amazing. I've thought through many times since then about how I ever managed to go through this thinking process that probably took a split second. Because as soon as I looked at this valley, I knew there was no place I could put this airplane. So I had to get out of it, mm-hmm. you know. And just like that, I just unhooked everything, climbed out the left side, and kicked out. And I saw the airplane still smoking, and I saw it one quick thing, and I looked back, and bam, it was that quick. And since then, I've tried to, in my mind, because people have a lot said, how high were you? I don't know how high I was, but it was in this valley, and I was heading down into the valley. And I, in my mind's eye, when I've tried to recreate those few seconds, and I think it was about no more than 5 seconds, maybe 4 seconds before I hit the ground. And my chute, I never got that jerk, you know, that you're supposed to get. The good Lord, I think, was watching over me that day. And my wingman, I found out much later, years later, he reported that, he said, I don't think he made it. He said, I didn't see that chute really blossom. It streamed out. But and I hit right on my heels and my rear end. And it went, bah, you know, I could feel it. It was terrible pain.
A, your chute never opened. But yet you survived,
partially.
Or never fully opened it, yet you survived. Maybe that is miraculous.
Yeah.
B, had you waited one more second?
Yeah, I wouldn't have had any room to bail out. I would have had to try to crash into the side of the... There was no place down there that was flat.
1 second, you know? And you would have been gone. Well, never would have seen your wife again. Three kids, 9 grandkids, 5 great-grandkids, wouldn't be here.
Yeah, I didn't think about those at the moment, but... Would,
Yikes.
Yeah, I think, and I've since, not because of that episode, but now that I'm old and closer to my maker, I've gotten religion and I now go to church every Sunday trying to make amends.
So you hit the ground, you mentioned your heels and your rear end. How long was it till you started feeling some pretty severe pain?
Oh, immediately. Right away. I couldn't stand up. It was that painful. I was on my hands and knees. And the Germans, they sent a patrol up, 6 or 7 men. And I could tell that they were looking for me. You know, they were pointing and talking. There's part of it I don't want to talk about, but within about 10 minutes or so, I was out of ammunition. And one guy said, "Stand up," in English. And I tried to stand up, and I closed my eyes. I thought, I'm going to get killed right now. And the only German words I could think of was kaput, you know. And I said, "Kaput, kaput." And so they came over, and they recognized that I was on my hands and knees. I could barely move. And so it still was very painful, but they took 2 rifles, and I sat on the 2 rifles and put my arms around these 2 Germans, and they carried me maybe 400 or 500 yards to some little dugout where they had, were spending the night. They had a little straw in a little tiny roof thing there, and I spent the night there. And then the next day, took me down to some little medical facility that Germans had. And I spent, I think, 2 days there. And they put a big piece of canvas from groin to up under my arms to try to support my back. And I started my sojourn up to Germany.
So now here you are, 21 years old, in that situation. How scared were you?
I was scared skinny. you do what you're trained to do, but when you're facing, your maker, you're probably not thinking properly anyway. But
And I imagine there was no assurance for you that these Germans capturing you are going to treat you right.
Oh, no, you're in the land of the unknown now. It could happen any time. Yeah.
What gave you hope in that situation? Because I'm sure you had to have some hope to keep going.
Yeah, well, it sounds kind of fluky, but you have to kind of come to grips with yourself, what you're faced with now. And I kind of knew where we were in the war, and, I knew we were winning. And I told myself, well, I'll give it 6 months, And at the end of the 6 months, if nothing's happened, then I'm going to have to do something. I thought, well, I'll wait 6 months, and if I'm still here, I'm going to have to then actively pursue something to get out of here, escape mm-hmm. or something. And it happened almost exactly 6 months to where, the war ended. And, as I mentioned when we started talking, Paul, being a prisoner of war is a degrading, humiliating kind of experience, and it's not something that I'm proud of. It didn't take any skill or specialty to get captured. And because I didn't finish my tour, and a lot of my friends did, and a lot of my friends were killed, I always felt guilty about being. I could tell from talking to other people in the camp, they have the same feeling, that it's a terrible guilt feeling that you're not helping at this point, Even though your instructions are, when you are captured, you are still a military, you're still U.S. Army, and your responsibility is to do what you can to, confuse, confound, and, aggravate the enemy as much as you can.
That's probably my favorite line from that movie, The Great Escape. It's put so well by, I think, one of the British officers, the character in that film, where he says it's the sworn duty of every serviceman to escape, do everything you can to escape. So did you do any of those things?
Well, I was, a junior. Here I am, a second lieutenant. Yeah. I'd just been shot down, and I was in a room with fellows that had been down since Tobruk, 4 years before that, So they had all the experience in the world, and I was a know-nothing, an American. But you knew that they had learned over the months and years how to survive mentally and emotionally, you know, in a prison camp. Now, the food, the movies never describe, you know, never get into this, but there is an absolute eternal hunger, a yearning for food. You don't get enough food, and you're hungry. It's gnawing at you. The only thing that kept us alive was Red Cross parcels used to come through. Not all the time, but when they came through, the package was about 11 pounds of food, and it had like a can of corned beef and some biscuits and a chocolate bar, a couple of packs of cigarettes, powdered milk in a can, you know, things of this sort. And it was designed to keep one man alive for 1 week. But the whole time I was a POW, the most they ever got was half a carton a week. So two men to a carton per week. So we were starving, you know, slowly starving. I only know my own experience, although everybody was turning into a skeleton. But I was always a tall, skinny kid. And when I was shot down, I weighed 165. And when I was liberated and the Americans weighed me, I weighed 125. Mm-hmm. So I'd gone through 40 pounds in just 6 months.
Makes you wonder how much longer you could have survived.
Yeah, it's this gnawing, and it's 24 hours a day. When you sleep, you dream about food.
Did you ever fear that you would die there in the POW camp?
Not right in the camp, but as the Russians were advancing, and of course the Americans and the British were advancing, the rumors started to come that we were going to be evacuated and taken down into an Austrian redoubt where the Germans were going to hide out to the end. The scuttlebutt was we were going to be the bargaining chip. They were going to hold us to the last minute and then bargain us out in terms of more favorable surrenders.
Right.
You know, and of course, we had been evacuated once from Sargon when the Russians got the
night. Tell me about that. That must have been quite an interesting experience.
It was a snowstorm, you know. We had been following, you know, the Russians, and we knew they were getting closer and closer. And the night they put us on the road, as we were being marched out of the camp, we could hear machine gun fire. Now, I don't know whether it was Germans firing, but the rumor passed through the group was that's the Russian advance patrols. They're that close that on the east side of Sargon, you could hear the machine gun fire. And, of course, we started marching west. And we went through, I think, 4 nights and 5 days marching. And it was that was the worst winter that they had had in 50 years in Germany.
Yeah.
And I read later, and I had heard some, you know, stories about it when we were doing this, how cold it was. But the average temperature, they were saying, for that march was 17 below zero. So it was freezing cold, you know. You know, a lot of people have referred to it as the German death march.
And, yeah.
And I never want to put it that bad, certainly. But there were a number of people we had heard that had been shot trying to run, you know, to escape.
Well, and there were some who had been marching before the Russians got to you because the Russians had got to them sooner.
Oh, yeah. There were parades of these people headed west, you know, from all of the camps that were out in the East End. That's when we ended up down at Moosburg, you know, which was about 30 miles northeast of Munich. I was reading somewhere where the camp was designed for 14,000. And I think they ended up with over 50,000 people. The day we were liberated in the morning, there was a big battle. We were right outside of Munich, right outside of Moosburg. We could see the town, the roofs, and there was a church steeple and a flagpole. You could see the German flag all the time. And there was just bang, bang, bang. It went on all morning. And so we knew that they were within, you know, a mile or so of us. And so we all waited and sweated. And we were in the toilet, which was a cement concrete building, and looking out the empty windows at this thing. And it had the German flag. And I guess around noontime, the shooting seemed to stop. And it was quiet for a while. And then the German flag came down. And we were all watching this. And an American flag... I can't even say it without. Yeah.
You're overcome with emotion right now, remembering that.
And it went up. And it was upside down the first time. Came down, and then it went up, and we all cheered.
Wow. Yeah. I can't imagine what that felt like after everything you've been through from the time that you got out of that airplane until then, I mean, that just had to be the most glorious thing you ever saw.
Yeah, it was. I'm sorry.
I think everyone understands the emotions that must be going through your heart right now.
Another one of my most emotional moments of my military career was we came into New York City, and we was, you know, as I said, the wounded came first, and then the POW. So we were very early in returning, and of course the country was still celebrating, you know, the fact that we had won. And as we're coming up the straits, you know, Staten Island and Brooklyn on one side, you know, the New York Harbor. On the Brooklyn side, there was a kind of grassy bank, and they had a sign in plants, you know, all very cleverly done. And here I go. I'm going to say, the sign said, "Welcome home. Well done."
Of the 130,000 Americans who were prisoners of war during World War II, 116,000, like Ray, got to hear those words, "Welcome home." But there were also 14,000 who died in captivity. We honor all of them today, as well as those still missing. We're overdue for our first break, but when we come back, a man who spent nearly 4 years as a prisoner and is now 102 years old. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
So before I lost consciousness, I just said to myself, God help me. And then I lost consciousness, and then while I'm still sinking to greater depths, even greater pressure, I'm conscious again. And just momentarily, I felt a kind of a euphoria that, hey, this is the afterlife.
It wasn't then, but now lucky Louis Zamperini is experiencing the afterlife with the book Unbroken and then the Hollywood film of the same name. Louis is certainly the most well-known of the dozens of ex-prisoners of war who have shared their stories on Hometown Heroes. By the way, a movie sequel is now in production. It's going to pick up the Olympian-turned-POW story where the Unbroken film left off, and it'll detail Louis' experience and exploits after emerging from captivity. I'll let you know when it's hitting theaters, but the working title is Unbroken: Path to Redemption. And remember, you can always access the interview we did with Louis at hometownheroesradio.com. This weekend marks National POW MIA Recognition Day, and I trust this program will serve as a reminder for you to pause and remember. If you happen to be in California and you can make plans for next weekend, I've been invited to speak next Saturday evening, September 23rd, in Bakersfield, California, at an annual event there to remember the missing and honor ex-POWs. At least four former prisoners of war will be there, including 102-year-old Jack Schwartz, who, like Louis Zamperini, was a prisoner of the Japanese. Jack was captured on Guam the day after the war began, and he wouldn't taste freedom again for 1,367 days, not until a couple weeks after the Japanese surrendered.
We never thought that we would win a war eventually, even though things were bad. And we didn't know how long it would take. The Japanese called it a 100 years war because what they called it the Eastern China Co-Prosperity Sphere. That's what they called it, and which meant that they were going to take over China and all the Orient, really. And we knew it would be that long, obviously. But there was no idea of how long it would take. And I think some died from discouragement. I really do, because we all had the same amount of food, and some just sort of gave up. In one of the camps I was at, I was in Yokohama for 2 years after, not at first. We lost about one man a month. I think just from discouragement. They had to work, but they all worked. The officers, incidentally, were not put to work. I think that's the only thing of the Geneva Conference that the Japs honored. I never knew why, but they did. They made us promise not to escape. Well, that was easy. Where we could escape to another island. Actually, it would have been easy to escape from the camp. But where do you go? You're an American in Japan. Who's not going to recognize you? And a few people did try to escape. They got caught the next day and brought back. Then the whole camp suffered. We had to stand at attention for all night long or something like that.
You mentioned guys dying from discouragement. So that begs the question, what kept you encouraged? What helped you believe that you would survive, that you would get home to see your wife again?
I'm not sure. I just think we have faith that we'd get recaptured. I mean, there's no doubt about it, we'd win the war eventually. As I've said, fortunately, I was not ever really sick. And we all lost weight, but we all wanted more food, but it wasn't to the point where we were emaciated. So just had faith, that was all.
And I want to talk to you about some of the conditions of the camps you were in and the way you were treated and what you had to eat and all that. But as far as communicating with your wife back home, was there a point at which you were able to get a letter to her and vice versa? Or were you guys without communication that whole time?
No, actually, we did get to, it was 3 or 4 months after we were captured that the U.S. was notified who the prisoners were. So at least the family knew I was alive. It was quite a bit of time after that when we were each allowed to write a postcard home, which of course was censored, but anyhow, we did write home. And in the course of the whole war, I probably wrote 4 or 5 postcards and got a few letters. I got one package from home. That was about the extent of communication. At least they knew we were alive. And the Red Cross sent packages now and then, but in my almost four years, I got one package. And there were more deaths than Jeff was confiscated, that was all. When we got the package, of course, it was a big deal. It had, among other things, butter and jam and some meat. And of all things, a package of cigarettes. And I don't smoke then. I didn't smoke now. And so training went on. I traded a pack of cigarettes for a jar of jam, as I recall it. There wasn't all that much communication, but it was good having even some.
And I'm sure that each camp was different. But when you think back on it all that time, what were the most difficult things that you had to deal with? Were you treated well? Were you abused? How would you describe the way you were handled as a prisoner by your Japanese captors?
Well, the first camp at Sensuji turned out to be just an officer's camp. And the Japanese used that for their show camp. If the Red Cross wanted to inspect a Japanese POW camp, they went to Sensuji. It was practically a country club compared to other camps. So there you have to say that outside of not eating enough, we were not abused, really. In fact, they tried to teach us Japanese, but they gave up after a while. Of course, we learned some things. You had to count off ichi, ni, san, chi, and so forth. And we learned the commands, how to turn right, turn left, sit down, you know, things like that. And a little Japanese. But here's something that's interesting. Once in a while, we got Japanese newspapers printed in English. Of course, this was near the beginning of the war. The Japs were winning all over the place. But we got the news anyway. And even a couple of years later, when I got back to Sensuji, we got 1 or 2 copies. And by then, of course, they were losing the war, and their reporting was quite a bit different. All in all, I've said ever since I came back that as POWs go, I was a very lucky POW. I was beaten a few times at Kawasaki because I was the senior officer there. And if anything went wrong, they blamed me. And I'd get beaten around the face, not wounded, really, just beaten up till you fall down and they stop. But the interesting thing is that the Japanese beat their own soldiers. A corporal could beat up a private. Just a different culture, that's all. So I'll say again, not only lucky to get back, I was lucky the way I was treated, really.
Because, in general, Japanese prisoners of the Japanese in World War II had a lot rougher circumstances, in most cases, than prisoners of the Germans did. But you look at even the longest held POW of the war in Japan, you feel like you were fortunate over there. Were you aware that others in Japanese captivity were being treated in worse shape than you were?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we got stories about him. And of course, I've read many stories about him since then. This was not in Sensuji, but I went to Kawasaki after about 6 months, along with the other two civil engineers from Guam, and we never knew why. And we guess it was because they shipped some Navy machinists up there. Maybe they thought engineers were machinists. Anyhow, when we got up, they said, oh, it's a mistake, we'll send you back. Well, they sent my friend Frank back after a year, and they sent me back after 2 years, and the third one stayed there through the whole war, and he was killed by American planes about 2 weeks before the war was over. I mean, Bob had hit the cab. So he lived through the whole war, never got home. So as I say, here I was lucky.
And I imagine when you hear a story like that, when you get that news, there's part of you that says, hey, that could have been me.
Well, sure, it could have been. Here's the other thing I was about to tell you. Up at this camp in Kawasaki, we had an English doctor. He was in the English Navy. How he got there is a different story, which you don't want to know about. But he treated the American prisoners, and he got beat up more than I did because he kept on trying to get prisoners' excuse of going to work. If he tried so hard, he'd get beaten up. He still kept it up. He lived through the war, and later on in 1946, I sent him packages because in England, they were really hard up for months after the war was over. So he got care packages from me as a return favor. But as I say, I've always said I was lucky.
Did recommend it. You wouldn't recommend being a POW for almost 4 years?
That's exactly right.
But that said, I imagine there's a lot of perspective that you've carried forward in your life that you wouldn't have if you had not endured all those years without the freedom that you treasure so much now.
I think so, because things that many people take real serious, and by comparison, they're not serious. And that's been my attitude really long.
Did you ever make friends with any of the Japanese guards or soldiers or officers?
Yes, I did. We had an interpreter at this second cabin in Kawasaki. I forget his first name. His name was Kondo. And we got quite friendly, really. And in fact, he treated us pretty well. We talked, and I had learned in prison camp to do a macrame. I don't know if you know what that is.
Sure.
We got a hold of the string, and I was making macrame wristbands. And the Kondo says, hey, make me one. I said, well, what are you going to do for me? And I knew what I wanted. I had seen in the paper that some bookstore was selling American books on calculus, and I wanted that.
You wanted you're in captivity. Your wife's back in the States. You barely have anything to eat, and what you want to trade for is a calculus book?
Well, anything else I could trade for. So I did, and he got it for me, and I worked every problem in the book. I should have saved the book, but I haven't got to have it. But it helped pass the time. Actually, in my situation, it was border more than anything else, because the officers didn't have to go to work. But what else was there to do? You sat around. There were only six of us there. Interesting thing, though, you were talking about attitudes. 1 year to date after the war was over, two of my friends committed suicide, two that had been in camp with me. So it did have a lasting effect on a lot of people. One was living in a room with me. He was a master sergeant from the Philippines. And the other was a Lieutenant J.G., who was captured in Guam. A very wealthy young man, too, incidentally. They committed suicide a year later, so it must have weighed on them very heavily. I was over it by then.
How'd you do that?
Heck, I don't know.
Well, I want to get to that moment of your liberation and everything that transpired from there. But you mentioned food, and I know you lost 50 pounds or so and got down to about 125. But give us a sense of what you did have to subsist on. What kind of food did they give you? And were there moments where you got something out of the ordinary that you appreciated a lot more than you might say now?
Well, basically the food was soup and rice. In fact, it wasn't always rice. As the war went on, we didn't get rice because some sorts of gravy we didn't recognize, but it was great anyhow. And the soup was mostly vegetable soup. I'm not sure if you know what a daikon is, do you? Mm-hmm. It's a huge white radish. Yeah. We had daikon soup day after day after day. And maybe once a month you'd find a tiny piece of fish or meat in it. So the only sick problem I had is I did get beriberi. And in fact, most of the prisoners got beriberi because there was none of the vitamin B in their food. And that beriberi did have an effect on me. It's affected me ever since in my life because it affected my walking. And it used to flare up and disappear. And in the last few years, it has disappeared, so my walking is terrible. And at our last camp up in Rokorochi, which was very isolated, not even a small town there. We were up there from June until the end of the war, and the food was no better, and the barracks were even worse. I sent away not so long ago a sketch of the camp that somebody had made. It's in the POW magazines and stuff. And on the upper deck, we each had 22 inches of space. On the lower deck, we each had 25 inches of space. So that's the way it is. If the war had not stopped, we probably would have frozen up there because they got snow up there all the time, and we had nothing for that. But fortunately, the war did stop. Japanese officers in charge of the camp came in and said, hostilities have ceased. And he and the guards just walked off and left us. There was no place we could go.
So you prisoners were all alone up there? No guards, no Japanese?
That's correct, but where are you going to go? So we painted a big POW on the roof of the barracks. And it wasn't until, I'm pretty sure it was at least 2 weeks before we saw a B-29 fly way, way above us. And 2 hours later, and parachutes were dropping out of the camp full of food. Boy, we all got crazy, throwing up all over the place, eating too much. But why not? Finally, a group of Army people came up, including nurses. And this is amusing, too. The first thing they did was spray us with DDT.
To kill all the lice?
Lice and fleas, stuff, bed bugs. We had them all. And, of course, they wouldn't do it now, but it did get rid of them anyway. And then there was, I didn't mark the date. I used to keep a diary, but I've lost it. But there was sometime about September the 8th when they finally came up with trucks and took us down to the railroads. And we took the railroad to Yokohama. There they separated out the Army and the Navy. And they put the Navy people aboard the U.S. Iowa, which was there, and just stayed there overnight. And we were still in rags. And they gave us uniforms. They wore Kappa uniforms then. And the next day they flew us out. So we get on the plane to fly out. The last thing I did before I got out was spit on the ground. And we flew for about a half an hour over Tokyo. What you could see was completely burned out. And then we came back and landed because one of the motors was no good.
Boy, you talk about a letdown after 4 years as a prisoner and your plane ride home has to go back to where you started.
Exactly. Anyhow, we took off again and flew back to Guam. What a difference, because instead of a little shabby island, there were airfields there, all kinds of things. And this is another funny one. They took us to the Naval Hospital. You'll never guess who was in charge. It was one of the Navy nurses who was captured with us, because the Navy nurses were sent home with the ambassador in May of 42. And here she was back on Guam again as the chief nurse. Of course, it was nice knowing somebody. And we stayed there for about a week and sort of got used to living again. We got all uniforms. They gave us each $100, as I recall it. And finally, we all got orders and shipped home. But we went home on a naval vessel. Here again, they didn't have room, but they built shells. We were sleeping three deep on shells. But this didn't matter because we were eating like pigs. And it took us 17 days to get home. It keeps getting funny, ha-ha. We got to San Francisco and land at Fort Mason and get off the ship. Oh, incidentally, while I was on Guam, I called my wife. I called her from Honolulu, so she was up here to meet me. What's between us and the families? A six-foot-high wooden fence. So here we are back in San Francisco. We're still prisoners.
But not for long. He would remedy that quickly, reunite with his wife, and go on to serve in the Navy until 1962. Jack is still going strong at 102, and you can link to his entire original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. Even better, you can meet him in Bakersfield, California, next Saturday night if you're available. More on that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, hearing from ex-prisoners of war today as we mark National POW/MIA Recognition Day. Ceremonies are taking place all over the country this weekend, and even a few next weekend. If you're anywhere near Bakersfield, California, where listeners have been catching Hometown Heroes on affiliate KNZR for years, I'd love to see you at VFW Post 97 as we honor and remember our POWs, as well as those still missing in action. I've been asked to go speak there, but the real reason to go is to shake the hands of at least four ex-prisoners of war. If you'd like more information, call this number, 661-496-4672. I have that number online for you also at hometownheroesradio.com. Again, it's 661-496-4672. You just heard from one of the POWs you can meet there on Saturday, Jack Schwartz. He's 102. Robert Farwell is only 98. He's going to be there as well. And it was 73 years ago this week, in September of 1944, that he was shot down on only his fifth mission as a B-17 pilot with the 306th Bomb Group.
The mission was an industrial complex that was about 80 miles southwest of Berlin. So we had to fly out over the North Sea, come in over eastern Germany, and fly down. We probably flew about 40 to 50 miles west of Berlin. And just as we were past Berlin, probably about 60 miles from the target. Of course, we were flying in flak all the time. And then about that time, our fighter escort left. And as soon as they left, we got jumped by a bunch of F-190s. And I think that's what ended up hitting our airplane.
And had you faced opposing fighters before, or was that the first time?
No, actually, that's the first time. Because in the other missions, we had fighter escort, and a lot of them were over a part of Germany that we were occupied. And by this time, the Germans were a little bit short of fighter pilots. So they didn't tangle with anything. They just stayed back, and they would just then only hit the bombers after our fighter escorts left.
So how did that unfold for you? You're up there in the left seat in the cockpit, flying this plane, and did someone see something? Did you see the fighters coming? How did you realize you were under attack?
Oh yeah, we saw them coming. We were flying, in, of course, in formation. I was leading the upper sixth element of the group. Gee, there were several groups. I'm not sure just how many airplanes in all that were going on that mission. Quite a bunch. We were in the lead group. We just ended up getting the head-on attack from the fighters. You know, it's just the way it was.
So you're looking out the front of the cockpit, and you see an FW-190 flying straight at you.
Four of them. Yeah, we can see them coming. There's nothing you can do about it. We've got a turret gunner, and the bombardier handles the lower turret. And, of course, we're shooting at them while they're shooting at us. And, you know, it's just the way it goes.
When you see those four planes coming at you, do you even have time to think? Do you have that moment where your heart sinks down into your stomach? I mean, what was that like?
No, you just plunge ahead. You can see them coming, but there's nothing you can do about it, except you've got guys on your side that are shooting at them, and you're so busy, you don't worry about anything else.
So what happened to your airplane? How much damage did they inflict?
Well, we got hit right in the cockpit, started a fire. So obviously what the shots did was go right into the cockpit area, and it broke propellers on a B-17 are operated with oil pressure. And then, of course, you've got oxygen lines all over. So what happened when it hit in front of the cockpit, it started a fire because it broke the oil lines and severed the oxygen lines. You know, the whole cockpit was on fire. So I motioned to the co-pilot. In the meantime, the bombardier and the navigator came out from below. I motioned for the co-pilot, you know, to get out. We pulled the hatch in there because my number three engine was hit too. So it was burning. So everybody bailed out. The co-pilot was first, then the Bombardier and the Navigator, then my engineer who was manning the top turret. And when they were all gone, then I went out. In the meantime, the gunners in back, the tail gunner and the two side gunners bailed out too.
You talk about the cockpit being on fire, and you're describing it very calmly and matter-of-factly, but it sounds like absolute chaos. Could you see anything in there?
Well, after a while, a lot of the smoke cleared. By the time I went to bail out, I think basically the fire was probably substantially depressed, because by the time the oil and the oxygen got together and that was burned off, there wasn't much else going on. The biggest problem then is the fire on the number three engine. Anyway, it was time to get out of the airplane.
And as you did exit that airplane, knowing the rest of your crew has already jumped off and you're bailing out, what did you see? What was the scene in front of you? Because you talked about how many planes were in this formation. What did you see as you bailed out?
Well, I knew that there was a lot of flak. There was a lot of any airplanes. There was a lot of metal flying around. So I said, I knew that we'd been briefed that the cloud formation, the tops were at about 18,000, and the bottom of the formation was at about 4,000. So I said, I'm going to wait until I can see the ground before I open my chute, because otherwise you've got falling airplanes, you've got flak all over the place. So when I got down to the point where I was just ready to come out of the clouds at about 4,000 feet, then I pulled the ripcord and the parachute took me down.
All right, I always try to imagine myself in the situation that the veteran is experiencing here, and this has got to be right up there with some of the scariest. In my mind, you're free-falling blindly through clouds for 14,000 feet.
From 28,000 to 4,000 feet, whatever that is.
24,000 feet, free-falling without seeing anything, really.
No, I was in the clouds.
What in the world is going through your head?
I was waiting to see the ground.
Were you scared at all?
Not really. You don't have time to get scared. You're just figuring what do you have to do? What do you do? What are you going to do? Where's the ground? And that's about it.
So you pull your chute, and then I imagine everything slows down a little bit.
Oh, yeah. By the time the chute opens and everything's calmed down, you're probably at about 2,000 or 3,000 feet. And fortunately, I'm about 40 miles just east of Berlin, and it's just farm country. And I'm floating down there looking at a hayfield, level and flat. When I'm at about 1,500 feet, I see a farmer with a pitchfork running towards where I'm going to be landing. And as I landed, he's there right with me. So there was no evasion, no escape, no nothing. So, as the saying goes, for you the war is over.
Did he actually say that to you?
They did. A couple of guys did.
I don't know if I've met a POW yet, at least in Europe, who wasn't told those specific words. And I imagine because you were the last one out of the plane and the plane's still moving, you're quite a ways from any of those other guys from your crew.
Yeah, I couldn't. There was nobody else near me that I could see. And, of course, we're not the only airplane. There was 12 Air B-17s shot down that day on that mission. I'm not sure how many airplanes there were on the mission, but, a couple hundred anyway. And 12 got shot down.
You weren't injured in any way? Weren't hit? Weren't burned? Nothing?
I had a helmet on and glasses, so my eyebrows were burned. And I had just flesh wounds, just kind of like sunburn on the part of my face that wasn't covered by an oxygen mask. Nothing serious.
I know it's a long time ago, and so much has happened since then. But if you can put yourself back in that position, and now you're a prisoner of the Germans, what do you think your expectation was for what the future held for you?
Well, I knew that it would, if I survived to get to one of the prison camps, that, we'd survive all right, because the Germans were treating the prisoners pretty much according to as close to the Geneva Convention as they could. because there was a lot of German prisoners, airmen in prison camps in the UK and in the US. So they wanted to do the best they could to protect the integrity of their own prisoners, making sure that they got treated well, too.
You were a pretty big, strong guy. I've seen these photos of this bomber pilot. How much did you weigh when you were captured?
Oh, I probably weighed about 185.
And how hard was it to get used to the food? Everyone tells me about the sawdust bread. Did you chip a few teeth on that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we got that piece of bread every day.
How hard was it? I've heard differing stories of how much was flour and how much was tree flour, the sawdust.
Yeah, I think it was probably about a quarter to a third sawdust. But, you know, we were so short of food, we ate it anyway. But if we had to depend on that and an occasional potato, why, we'd have all starved to death.
And what was it that kept you thinking positive, believing that you're going to come out of it? Where do you think that spirit, that mindset came from for you?
Well, we were confident, absolutely, that we were overcoming them, that the Germans were on the run. And I guess part of it was because of this, radio we had and the little newspaper that got circulated, so that we were pretty well aware of how the war was going. So we were confident that we were going to get out of there, before long.
And I saw in your scrapbook a postcard that you sent to your wife. Did you ever get any mail from her? Did you have any idea whether she knew you were alive or dead or safe or anything?
Yes, I got the only letter I got there was from her sister. So she told me that they had received a letter that I was shot down, and then a few weeks later that I was a POW. And got an address that way she could write to, and I got that letter from her sister. In the meantime, my wife wrote a letter to me, I guess every day, never got one. But when the war was over with, they were all sent back. And I don't know, God, there must have been 50 of them. And I read a lot of them when I was back home.
When that liberation came, what was that like for you? I'm sure you had dreamt about that moment for a while.
Oh, yeah, it was an exciting time. We ended up at Camp Lucky Strike. We were there, we were probably there about a week. And then we ended up on a ship that left Le Havre and landed in New York. We ended up getting on a train and going across the country, dropping people off on the way. And I ended up then in Sacramento. And I met my wife at a hotel there.
What was it like to actually see her face again?
It was great, yeah.
You haven't struck me as an overly sentimental guy or one that gets too emotional about things, but I've had a lot of other POWs tell me that when they sailed into New York Harbor, that there was something else they saw that had a particular significance to them. Did you see the Statue of Liberty? Did it mean anything to you?
Oh, yeah. We went right past it, you know. No, that was thrilling to see that. You could almost spit at it. We were, at least that's the way you felt. No, that was a great sight. It was a good moment.
And a symbolic moment. The liberty and the freedom we enjoy in this country are of such great value that millions and millions of Americans have been willing to risk their lives in order to preserve it. Whether this is the first time you've heard about National POW MIA Recognition Day or you've been tuned into that for a long time, mark it on your calendar for next year, the third weekend in September. You can access the complete original interviews with the three ex-prisoners of war we heard from today at hometownheroesradio.com. And maybe you'll get to meet a couple of them next week if you join us in Bakersfield, California. After everything we heard today, I'm pretty sure I don't need to remind you, but I will anyway, as I thank you for listening today. Let's wrap up the show as we do every week with these four words. Freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.